So, Sarah.
So, Kelly.
Did you know there's a new book out?
Tell me about the book you're reading, Kel.
Okay, so I just finished reading The Grieving Brain by Dr. Mary Frances O'Connor.
Wasn't it fantastic? I couldn't honestly put it down.
It was awesome. And it was so timely for me. It was just really good.
I agree. And you know what's awesome about today?
What's that?
We get to talk to the author, Dr. Mary Frances O'Connor, about The Grieving Brain.
We do. I'm so excited.
I'm so excited. Let's get into it. This is The Unchosen Fork. I am Sarah.
And I'm Kelly.
And today we have on the amazing Dr. Mary Frances O'Connor, who recently published The Grieving Brain. Mary Frances O'Connor is an associate professor of psychology at the University of Arizona, where she directs the Grief, Loss, and Social Stress Lab, or GLASS, in investigating the effects of grief on the brain and the body. Dr. O'Connor earned a doctorate from the University of Arizona in 2004 and completed a fellowship at UCLA. Following a faculty appointment at UCLA Cousins Care for I have aphasia as part of my disease, so this is fun. Psychoneuroimmunology, she returned to the University of Arizona in 2012. Her work has been published in the American Journal of Psychiatry, Biological Psychiatry, and the Psychological Science, and featured in Newsweek, The New York Times, and The Washington Post. Having grown up in Montana, she now lives in sunny Tucson, Arizona. Welcome, Dr. O'Connor.
Thank you. It's so nice for you to have me. And please call me Mary Frances.
I will do so. I am so excited to have you on this. I know I chased you down a little bit, but we just did our little intros. And in that intro, we talked about how much we loved your book. Oh. Both Kelly and I adored it. We were texting each other about it as we were reading it, just to let you know.
It's great to have you here. I have to say the brain is one of my most favorite parts of the human body. So reading your book was pretty great for me.
It's such a just magnificent organ, all the things it can do.
It really is. I'm fascinated with the brain too, because my disease, Hashimoto's encephalitis, actually it has attacked the brain. I'm constantly interested in new things to find out about how the brain works. And it's just such a complicated organ. Wow. I'm swimming with sharks here, you know, yeah. But it's really so fascinating. And I loved your book for that point. We talk about the unchosen fork as these are paths that have chosen us, not that we would have chosen. I would love to hear your unchosen fork story if you'd like to share.
This is something people often ask. And, you know, I'm not sure as a psychologist how good we are at understanding our own motivations sometimes. But I will tell you that my mom was diagnosed with stage 4 breast cancer when I was 13. And I didn't know it at the time, but she was not supposed to survive the year. And she lived another 13 years, which felt like a gift from the universe for my sister and I. And so she died when I was 26. But what it meant was that I never had difficulty after that being with people who were grieving. Like, it just doesn't bother me if you cry uncontrollably, you know? And that enabled me to do these clinical interviews and then to really listen to what people were saying and try to map that on to what I was seeing in the brain images through neuroimaging as they were experiencing grief. And so, you know, it is funny how these unchosen forks kind of shape where we go and who we are.
Mm-hmm. I agree. Kelly and myself have talked about how the changes that we've gone through in the last couple of years have really changed our lives dramatically in every kind of way. For me, I changed my career. My relationship with Kelly has changed. I think we've become a lot closer. The grieving part, and I will say this is the first episode that we're really talking about grief, is really interesting for me because I feel like as a society, we don't handle grief very well and we don't embrace it maybe the way that it can be to make it easier. I don't know. I'm not the expert, but that's just my observation.
I also think that for some people, grief could be their unchosen fork. Losing someone in their life, it is their unchosen fork because that's not what they had planned on.
Yeah.
I mean, the fear of that is sometimes my unchosen fork.
It's terrifying. Yeah. Absolutely. And I think that as a culture, there's a lot of different ways that we deal with it, but it is true that, you know, our culture likes us to be happy. That is the point, right? And when you're grieving, you're not usually feeling a lot of happy. And that can make you feel really disconnected from the people around you. And on the flip side, when you're grief adjacent, when you care for someone who's grieving, it's hard. It's hard to watch. It's hard to see someone you care about suffering. And that can make you want to cheer them up because, you know, it's uncomfortable. But really that can, you know, add to this disconnect. That's not how I'm feeling. And so instead, rather than trying to cheer them up, I think it can be much more about being with them and saying, no, you can't imagine a different future at the moment, but I can imagine a future. And you know what? I'm going to be with you until you get there, whatever that future looks like. I'm going to be here by your side.
And is there a way to prepare for that? Because I feel like we do not, you know, when we sit with grief, we often, it's often a shock, right? It's a shock to the system and everything. And it's one of those things of you take a gasp and yet grief is a long process. So is there a way to prepare for either your grief, if you know that somebody's, for example, in a devastating diagnosis, or even someone else's, for example, if you have, you are grief adjacent, like you said, is there a way that we can prepare for that in a better way to not be so uncomfortable in that moment?
I think that the shock part is almost inevitable. I mean, even when you know someone is going to die, I mean, we knew for 13 years that my mom was going to die, and you still can't imagine what it's going to feel like that next morning. You just can't, because the brain really understands our loved ones as everlasting. You're there for me and I'm there for you, and that's it, you know. So I don't know that there's a way to overcome that, but I know a few things from research that suggest getting a chance to have a conversation where you get to say goodbye, where you get to express your gratitude or your forgiveness, or ask for forgiveness. Having a chance to have that conversation where you get to say goodbye, where you maybe get to express gratitude or ask for forgiveness or give forgiveness. Those conversations we know are really important in giving people a sense that there's no unfinished business after. Not all of us get that chance, right? It depends on how the death happens, of course. But if there is some indication, that can be an important thing to do.
I think there's also just tolerating grief as a way to practice, right? Things are passing away all the time, from, you know, last night's amazing dinner to a friend who moves away. And I think there's a way, you know, I'm in this friend group, and in this very small group, two of them lost their mom within just a month or two of each other. And they spent a lot of time talking about it in our group. And one day, one of them, her son, was there, and he was probably 14 or 15 at the time. And I think we were, you know, watching football at a pizza restaurant or something, you know, and these two friends are sort of talking about their experience. They were where they were at the moment. And her son says, "Mom, this is so depressing. Do we have to talk about this?" And she said, "You know, the thing is, it's really helpful for the two of us to get a chance to share with each other. And so I think it's okay. I think it's okay to stick with this topic for a little while." And I just was so struck by the teaching in that moment of, this is something we can tolerate and it's really helpful. So bear with us. You know, if I can think of one way that we might prepare, it's by really trying to tolerate intense emotions.
So I want to tell you what I got from your book that you taught me. As I was reading your book, my grandfather, who was 95, and I did have the opportunity to have a wonderful goodbye with him. He had a very sincere goodbye with everyone. But as I was reading your book, the very next weekend was his memorial service. Yeah. And I went to his house, and it was the last time I would go to my grandparents' house, most likely. And I remembered what you had written about how your brain stores the piece that you should know right where they are. And that's how sometimes you think that they're still alive because your brain sees them there. I cried as we drove into the neighborhood because I knew this was the last time I would be arriving there. And then I got inside and I just told myself, now remember, he's not going to be sitting on the porch reading a book or watching a football game. Just remember, you're going to look over there and he's not there. And I have to say, that kind of helped me a little bit to recognize that, okay, your brain's going to tell you this and it's not true. You know, it's not true. So prepare yourself for that.
That's so much to deal with that, you know, your brain takes a really long time to update.
I love that part too, Kelly, because one of the things that I learned from the book is that your mind is constantly mapping where people are in your life. And that was amazing. I realize I do that all the time. Where is my child? He's at school. Where is my spouse? He's at work. It was amazing to see that in print and be like, oh, my brain is actually doing that. I would love to hear how you guys found that out, right? Because I think that that was amazing.
They're like the push notifications, you know? Oh, it's 4 o'clock. Do you know where your child is? You know?
Right.
And it's because our loved ones are as important to us, as necessary to us as food and water. And yet they have minds of their own. They can wander about in the world. And so there's this invisible attachment bond, you know, this tether between us that enables us to return, you know, at a particular time and place. We know how to get back to our loved ones because they're so important. And so maybe it's not so surprising that the brain would spend a lot of effort trying to bring to awareness, but really, do you still know where they are? Mm-hmm. And I think that that comes from attachment theory and then the sort of science that has helped us to understand how that happens neurobiologically.
And you used the fMRI technology to do this research, which we just talked about MRIs a couple of weeks ago. Kelly and I were blown away. We had the dude from GE here talking about how MRIs work because I had no clue. My mind was blown. It is amazing that this technology can be used in a way that is talking about how to identify how grief operates in the body. Like, I'm fascinated by it.
Yeah. And I don't know. I'm guessing you were talking about structural MRIs, which is like I get an MRI on my knee or I need to see if there's some hole in my brain, right?
Right. Well, I get the brain one where they're like, yeah, it's still damaged. Still damaged. Yeah.
But yep, we did ask him about functional MRI a little bit.
Right. We did. Good.
Because that's the just magic to me that when I was in college, you know, there were maybe a handful of fMRI, functional magnetic resonance imaging machines around the world. And I thought, wow, someone can peer into the black box of your mind, of your brain. That's incredible. Never imagining that I would ever get to actually do that. But what's so fascinating is that, you know, when you use your neurons, right, when you're thinking, the specific place in your brain needs more blood flow because the neurons are firing and so they need to be reoxygenated. And so it's actually an inference. We see where the blood is flowing and that tells us where the neurons are firing. So there's a lot of physics I don't understand, but I know enough how to interpret and use the images.
That's amazing. And I love the fact that the science is constantly evolving and you guys are constantly looking at different things and trying to push that limit. One of the things that I was really fascinated by in your book was we have these stages of grief that everyone knows and they're outdated. The stages of grief, denial, anger, bargaining, depression, and acceptance, right? That you present a whole new model of how grief actually works. And that was amazing to me. And I would love to hear more about that.
Yes, I wanted to talk about that because I do feel like it is a much better representation of how we feel grief because people do go about their everyday lives while they're grieving in some capacity. And this kind of explains how you're able to do that.
Well, you know, many people don't realize those stages were published in 1969. So you think about all the research that's been done since 1969, right?
It's a long time. And I love the fact in the book you say, even Kubler-Ross would say that they're outdated.
And I have enormous respect for Dr. Elizabeth Kubler-Ross. She was a woman in psychiatry when there were not a lot of women in psychiatry. And she had this revolutionary idea that you could talk to people who were terminally ill and ask them how they were feeling, you know, which was just
imagine
shocking.
Going to the patient and asking them how they're feeling. I'm shocked.
Revolution. And so what we got from that was actually a really good description of grief, right? What someone is feeling in the moment. And it can be any of those feelings that you listed. What happened was, I think it's helpful to make this distinction between grief and grieving. So grief is that in the moment, you might feel this wave of sadness or this wave of yearning or anger or whatever. But grieving is the way that grief changes over time without actually going away, right? And so the newer model that we talk about is called the dual process model. And the idea is that there are two different kinds of stressors that we have to deal with when we're grieving. And one of them is the loss-oriented stressors. This is typically what we think of when we think of grief. It's all those feelings and thoughts and having to deal with the intensity of it all, the confusion, the numbness, all of that. But then there are this other set of stressors that we call the restoration stressors. This is, how am I going to restore a meaningful life now? I have to do new things that, you know, my partner always did, or I have to imagine a world where my child doesn't go to college because he's not living anymore. And all of those, how to understand new relationships, how to understand retirement, you know, all of those are also very stressful. But the magic about this model for me is that the sign of mental health is really being able to deal with both kinds of stressors and to oscillate between dealing with the grief and dealing with the sort of restoration of your meaningful life. And, you know, in the morning, you might be going through your husband's clothes because you have to, you know, sort out what's going to go where. And in the afternoon, you might be, you know, at your daughter's soccer game and just completely pretending like nothing ever happened and you're just cheering for your daughter. So it's the flexibility of being able to go in and out. So with grieving, we see that the feelings of grief change for most people over time. They become less frequent or less intense. And just as you said, Kelly, then you're spending sort of more of your day in just everyday life stuff and less of your time dealing with these stressors. But at any time, you might become aware of the fact that you have had the death of this person, that this person isn't with you now. And so in that moment, you're going to feel grief. You're going to have a wave of grief. But it doesn't mean there's anything wrong with your grieving. It doesn't mean you had a change in how that experience feels over time. It's just in that moment, you're aware again.
Yeah, I love that. I do think that the model that was before said, oh, you go through, and I'm very much like this. So I was like, I love this model. You go through it and then you're done with it.
Yeah.
You can box it up. You can put it on a shelf. You're done with it. Okay. Washing my hands and I can walk away. And that is not how grief works. That is not, I mean, how it works at all. This new model is allowing for that experience when, oh, you know what? I may grieve 3 years later, 6 years later, 8 years later, yeah. 20 years later. You know, I still cry that my grandmother's gone. That model and that understanding gives me the permission to be in that grief in that moment and be present in that moment and be like, it's okay that you miss her. You're having a moment of grief and that's okay.
Yeah. You know, we so much want to know, when is it over? When does this end? Yeah. And I think, right? I mean, everything from people themselves who are in the middle of that acute moment of grief of sort of like, oh my gosh, this is unbearable. Tell me when this ends. To, you know, I talk to medical residents and they're like, no, but really, how many weeks is it? Because I need to know, you know, exactly how many. So sometimes I say to people, you know, when did you get over your wedding day? Right? Like,
that's not
a question that makes any sense, right? Get over your wedding day. It's an event that transforms you and it changes everything about your life. But it doesn't mean that you don't have other parts of your life as well. It's just you're carrying the absence of this person with you. And they're still a part of you, even though they're not revealed to the rest of us all the time. And so there's going to be moments where you're sad or upset that they're not here. And there's going to be a lot of moments when you're doing everyday life and doing things that you value maybe because you understand grieving and mortality.
And is all grief the same? We did talk about how we grieved, and I use that word because that's the word that we used, which was grieving the life that we could have had if we didn't have this unchosen fork. Is that the same? Like, is that in the brain the same experience, even though it's not necessarily the loss of a person?
It's such a great question. I get this question all the time. And I give sort of two parts to the answer. So the first one is that, you know, in terms of us as a species, as I said before, our loved ones are vital to our survival. And so it makes sense that we would evolve some way in our brain of connecting with people and then what happens when we have to understand that they're not here. So I think of it as, when you bond with someone, it's the bond that gets encoded first, right? And so when you fall in love with your spouse or you fall in love with your baby, that actually changes the way the proteins are folded in your brain, you know? And then when that person dies, your brain has to understand, how do I update this world where that person isn't here, even though I still feel this bond? So on the one hand, you can say, well, then you mean grief is only about people, it's only about loved ones even. But there's another layer to it, which is this. When we bond with someone, it changes our own identity, right? So think about the word daughter. I'm a daughter, I use that word to describe myself. But it actually implies two people, doesn't it? Or the word sister implies two people. The word spouse implies two people, even though you use it to describe yourself. And so there's another level at which grief is also about losing a part of yourself. How do I be a good daughter in the world when my mother isn't here? Like, well, how do I understand myself? And so I think of grief as being a natural reaction to loss of a part of ourselves, of something that helps us to function in the world. Well, when you think about it that way, then it doesn't have to only be a person. Loss of health is the way that you've always functioned in the world, and now you don't have that same identity. Or loss of a job is the same thing. You aren't the secretary anymore. You aren't the IT support anymore. And that changes who you are. So I think of grief as loss of a part of yourself, that a way of you being in the world, whether that's because of your relationship or some other part of your identity.
Mm-hmm. I love that. And it's so true, because you do have these sense of selves. And I say yeah. Selves because, you know, it's helpful. I will say that it's been helpful to talk about that loss and that loss of whatever that self was. And that, you know, and Kelly and I talk about, that wasn't even a real person, right? But it was a real person in our future to us, right? It's very helpful. I talk about that in that way. So it's really lovely to hear that. And you know, you talk about co-rumination in the book, about talking about it. I found it really beneficial. I can't speak for Kelly, but they've had this conversation and maybe they need more help than I can give them. What's that point? Is there a line? Is that just everybody's own experience? How do you know when they've slipped into like the complicated grief or something like that?
I really wish I could hand out dipsticks that are like, you know, if you're here and find out if you're ruminating too much, right? Yeah. Unfortunately, it doesn't so much work that way. I mean, maybe. I'm not saying that we will never get to a point where, you know, we know what that line is. But I think we have to think about it in terms of the big picture. So I'll give you a couple of examples. So my dad was a widower, and he liked to adopt the other widowers in my little tiny hometown, and he would make them dinner and so forth. He was a lovely man. And he called me once and told me about a good friend of his whose wife had died. And he said, you know, this friend wants to sit with me in the evening and open these photo albums and show me the trips that they took together and, you know, all these pictures. And he said he wants to do it, you know, all the time. And I said, well, Dad, from the stories you've told me about the two of you, it's also true that you both go bowling, right? And you both volunteer at the church, and you also go to the movies. And there are many parts to your life. And I said, I think if you can bear it, it's okay to have him explain to you what it means that he has lost this critical person. And he told me much later that over time, he just didn't do it as much. He didn't. It's not that he never did, but he just stopped taking the albums out as much. And he said, you know, I think if you hadn't encouraged me, I probably would have to sort of shut down. But clearly it was something that he needed. But I think in balance with the many other aspects of his life, I think of that as being part of it, is this conversation that you're having and often having repetitively, right? You're sort of getting together with someone and sort of talking about how you're feeling, how you're doing. Is it really helping in the long run or not? And is it making your life more meaningful or is it making your life harder? I think that's ultimately the question and only you can really answer that.
I think I'm going to have to ask Kelly some questions after this podcast.
You always have questions, Sarah.
I'll give you a different example that sort of shows the flip side. So a woman who I was talking with, she had experienced the death of her child right after birth in the neonatal unit. And so she had joined this support group for other parents who had experienced the death of an infant. And after months and months of going to this group, her husband said to her, you know, you say that you want to feel better, but my experience of you is when you come home from this group, you don't seem to feel better. Although that was hard to hear, she said she realized eventually that she could still volunteer. So she started working as a volunteer with people who had newly lost an infant, right? Sort of helping them to feel more normal and what they can expect and so forth. But she stopped going to this group because she realized she wasn't learning anything new about her experience. She was just sort of mulling it over and over and over and being aware of what she had lost and that wasn't helping her in the big picture.
So I have to say, one of the things I loved about your book is your stories. So thank you so much for sharing these, because these were not in the book. Mm-hmm. For anybody reading it, we've talked about the brain and functional MRIs and all of that, but it truly is an easy read for how much science is in it. And the stories just link it, just really kind of help you to understand it. If you want to use layman's terms or however you want to explain it, it just really helped me to understand it. But also at the same time, I felt like you were very brave to connect yourself and your story so much in it, because a lot of people don't do that.
Yeah. And it was definitely novel as a scientist. That's in our role. But I will tell you, I think one of the reasons that Elizabeth Kubler-Ross's stages have stuck is because she wrote for you. She wrote for the general public. She published On Death and Dying, and there was a big spread in Life magazine about it. And, you know, as I came to realize I was doing all this research for 20 years, and I'm reading all these studies, and I have all these colleagues that are doing amazing bereavement science, and no one was getting the information that could help them. And so I thought, how can I write this, you know, in a way that my undergraduate would understand, or the person next to me on the plane that I have a conversation with? What would be different if they had access to all the information that I do? And one of the easiest ways to explain that was, let me tell you about my own grief experience while knowing all the stuff that I know, not because you're going to have the same experience, but because you can take some of these ideas probably and apply them to your own life in whatever way works for you. You're the expert on you.
I've already passed this book on to three different people. Only because, okay, so I have this theory. This is Sarah, non-scientific. I have nothing to do with science, but here's my theory. There is a point in your life when you cease getting good news. Bad news starts to overwhelm the good news, right? So I argue that at some point we are at that crescendo and then we are on the downhill of the good news. I have a couple friends that are on that downhill and I sent them your book and one of them wrote me back via text because we don't talk on the phone anymore because why would we? And said, you know, I really appreciate the science, but I really love the chapter where she talked about saying goodbye to her dad. It was so helpful because I think she was in the same place with her mom. And she's like, you have no idea how useful that was for me in this moment. So I just wanted to pass that on to you because I said, A, I said I would, and B, the stories that Kelly is talking about is a way for people to really understand the science and not feel that, oh, they have to have this advanced degree or have passed 10th grade biology, which, you know, some of us did not. I did, but maybe some others.
But even down to the hairdresser story and her sister and the voles, I could kind of see them mating, you know, like in my brain as I'm reading it, neurotransmitters or hormones going, you know, it was just, it really kind of kept me in the story to keep wanting to read and really learn this. And I, you know, I've read a lot of research articles and things like that with my background. It can get really boring at times. And this kept me there.
That's so good to hear, right? Because I think it's sometimes that there's data, but then it's like, why is the data important?
Right.
Mm-hmm. I need someone to curate for me. I need someone to take the data, but then to explain to me, why do we care? You know?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And disseminating information just seems to be the hardest thing in mental health, just general physical health, all of that. I mean, Sarah and I have talked about how long it takes stuff from clinical research to get into practice. And so this is, in my mind, a really great way to just get this information out there and in a way that people can, you know, pick it up. And I'm saying light reading in a good way, that it was very easy to read, but I still learned a ton.
Wow. You were sneaky, Dr. O'Connor. You were sneaky with your information.
She just peppered it in there.
Peppered it in there. Then all of a sudden I learned something new. Oh my gosh.
Stories are the way that we remember stuff, right? Like, you can't remember a list, but if you know it's, you know, a list of things to make stuffed peppers, then you can suddenly remember the list.
Right. Mm-hmm. It's like, so my grandfather, who recently passed away, the priest ended up speaking and saying it, but I wrote something and it said he was a gardener. And I was like, I'll never forget to trim my azaleas before the 4th of July and to plant my tomatoes before Easter, because that is how he always did things, was by holidays. And it is, you remember things so much better that way.
And that then carrying him forward.
Absolutely.
You know, the thing that I hear from that is he remains in your brain, right? And you perceive the seasons through having loved him and carrying on things that were important to him. So you're revealing his presence in your life.
Mm-hmm. Isn't that a wonderful thing?
It is.
It really is. So, Dr. O'Connor, I want to ask you, is there anything else that we didn't touch on that you would like us to discuss about the book? Because, I mean, I could really go chapter by chapter, but I'm not going to fangirl out. I promise, Kelly, I wouldn't. So,
wait, can we also say that you mentioned Stranger Things in there, which I thought was really cool as well.
Go season 4.
I'm watching the new season and I was like, oh, I did put this in the book.
You did.
I think there's one other thing that I would probably mention, because I've heard people say this is very helpful to them, is that, you know, one of the flavors of thoughts that we get stuck in is what I call the would have, could have, should have, you know. And so this is that if only they would have known the train was going to be late, if only I could have gotten them to the hospital sooner, the doctor should have ordered another test, right? And the thing about those thoughts is there are an infinite number of them, and there are no real answers, right? So they're questions, but there are no real answers. And if you think about it, each of those virtual realities that we're playing out, they all end in, and then my loved one lived. If I had only gotten them to the hospital sooner, my loved one would have lived. And the trouble with that is your loved one didn't live. And so if we spend a lot of time in our mind in this sort of virtual reality, and often these feelings come along with a lot of guilt or anger or blame, we're not really spending those moments in the present. And yes, the present has this pain and suffering, but it's also the only place to experience joy and compassion and love and all the good things as well. And so if you're disconnected from the world around you because you're in your head, then I think that can make it much harder to restore a life that feels meaningful to you.
I am so glad you added that, because right after I read your book, I was talking to someone who said something like, if I just would have, and I was like, but you don't know that that's would have made a difference, and you can't turn back time. And it was all because you wrote it in your book that I said that.
And it's not going to, you know, these are natural thoughts. People have these, especially early on. So, it's not like you have to try and push them out of your head per se.
Sure.
But maybe sometimes eventually thinking, or maybe I'm going to focus on what's going on, you know, in the coffee shop around me right now.
Mm-hmm. I love that. You know, Kelly talks a lot about being in the present, and I'm working on it. I can get into that spiral real easy, real easy. I could slip into that, like, I don't know, sweatpants, right? You have to remind yourself, okay, you know, is this serving me in this moment? 90% of the time, 99.9% of the time, it's no, it is not serving me. And I need to remind myself of that. So I love that.
It takes practice. You know, the reason that mindfulness is considered a practice, right? Why people like stop and sit on a cushion is because it's hard to figure out what your mind is doing and where it's going. And oh, there it goes again, you know? And so I think it is hard. And when we're able to practice a little bit over time, it can get a little easier. So you're not just doing it when you have the headphones on or when you're, you know, but you suddenly, it'll come to you like, oh, I haven't really been paying attention to these two lovely women in front of me and what they actually think and are feeling and that I like talking with, you know. I think then it will occur to you at other times, but sometimes it takes a lot of practice first.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, I practiced a lot and it was really out of necessity. I mean, I just didn't know what the future held. And so you live in the moment because you don't know what's coming around the next corner. And that is probably the best practice I've gotten out of this horrible unchosen fork.
I would have to agree with that. And, you know, as someone who definitely lived in the future, it's probably a little bit more of a struggle for me right now, but, you know, we'll see where I get to.
Yeah. And, you know, secret, it's hard for everybody. We, you know, our minds, they go all over the place. And it's just sort of like when you get to be in the moment, being like, aha, hooray, you know, back at the ranch, I'm here again, you know.
I did want to ask you one last thing that kind of came to me as I was re-skimming some things tonight before we talked. So with COVID, I'm just curious if you've done any work with families who lost loved ones during COVID and they were unable to be with them. Kind of what you might be finding with that or what your thoughts are with that. Because for a long time, people couldn't be with their loved ones, whether distance kept them apart or whether they were in the hospital and they weren't allowed in. There's a lot of different reasons as to why. And I was just curious if you are doing any work on that.
I have been doing first some survey work, and then I, along with a couple of my clinical psychology students, we conducted interviews, phone interviews with a large number of people who, just as you say, had had the death of a loved one during the pandemic, some to COVID and some not to COVID, but many were still restricted from seeing their loved one, regardless of why they were in the hospital or long-term care. And I'm literally just analyzing these data right now, yesterday, today. But what we are finding is the unexpectedness and not getting to say goodbye, not getting to have that meaningful conversation, seems to be troubling for them, that it seems to be creating a more severe grief, more difficulties. And so, you know, I think it doesn't mean that people aren't resilient in the long run, but I think there's something that in the future we will really need to consider. What is the right way to deal with end-of-life care, even during a pandemic? Is this the right way? Because what is the mental health cost? So we'll see where that goes.
I work in a hospital, and that was the one exemption, was if it was end of life, even when we were shut down to visitors. But at that point, you know, it was one or two people in your family and that was it. And a lot of people are fortunate to have many more people than that in their lives.
Yeah.
This is a heavy topic. Is there a sense of grieving on a larger scale? Like, can nations grieve? I experienced 9/11 in a very specific way. I wasn't there, not preaching that. But I feel like there was a grief in the nation. And I feel like there's a lot of other incidents that happen. I mean, one recent.
Do you feel like there is a nationwide grieving that happens, you know, that is not necessarily tied to a specific person, right? But maybe it's tied to an event.
I think as we were talking about this idea that you lose a part of yourself often, that's often what grief is sort of at its base. I think obviously a nation can also lose its usual way of being, right? Or its sense of how it functions or its prestige or so forth. And I will say that, you know, different communities also react differently. I think that there are ways in which collective grief can happen that are unique and are really understudied. With a graduate student of mine who is a young Black woman, we've been talking a lot about collective grief and how the community, the African American community, is often very uniquely bonded because of the history that they have, where they have witnessed the deaths of people who look like them over and over and over. And because of this history of being forced, separated from their families, there was a development of something they sometimes call fictive kin. You know, you'll hear people call each other auntie, or you'll hear them say brother or sister. And in that community, there is a different collective sense, I think, often. And so when something happens to someone who looks like you or looks like your brother or looks like your uncle, I think that there can be this community level grief that we know very little about because we just haven't been doing research in that area. And I look forward to a future where there are, you know, where my psychology graduate student graduates and gets to go on to have a whole research career, and that we have more voices in science.
Kelly and I talk about this a lot, where I feel like at the end of every episode, we're saying, but more research is needed, you know, and that's kind of where we end almost every time we're talking about science, is that like, well, this is just the tip of the iceberg, like more information is needed. I feel like that's with grief as well. I was thrilled to read your book for, I mean, many reasons, but one of the reasons is that I feel like we don't read enough about it, like you were talking about earlier, like it's just not, you know, it's just not accessible in that way. I completely agree with what you said earlier.
Yeah.
So I am so excited because I get to do the bite size today.
Bite size.
Kelly normally does it, and I'm pulling it right from your book. So the bite size today is that in 2022, the DSM-5-RT put the prolonged grief disorder in that international classification of diseases. And I think that this was so interesting to me because, A, it was 2022. So it was this year, prolonged grief disorder, if I understand it, it's an intense emotional pain. It's a feeling of disbelief and inability to accept loss or difficulty engaging in activities, you know, et cetera, et cetera. And what I read that as, oh, this is when people are dying from a broken heart. This is when people are essentially dying from that broken heart because they're stuck in their moment, right? Like you said, they're stuck in that spiral. And it's so amazing to me that that is now a recognized disorder, because that means that they can get help, or at least that people can start to talk about getting help, that they can say, yeah, this is like, naming something sometimes is so powerful for people. It can be the pinprick of light that gets them out of their deep dark hole. I was amazed by it. I was so excited to read that. And it showed me kind of just what you said a couple of minutes ago, how far we have to go.
Yeah. 20 years.
20 years, right?
That's how long it takes.
Generation. We talk about this all the time, that it takes a generation, right? 20 years. In terms of prolonged grief disorder, is there anything that we could encourage people to seek out, either recognizing it or getting help for it?
The challenge with this is that I do worry that it will be overdiagnosed, that people will sort of diagnose themselves as having it, you know, because...
having a WebMD moment, if you will.
Yeah. You know, we're all going to have suffering, right? That is the natural part of loss. And so these are really people who, you know, I was talking about change over time. There's just no change over time. That the way they feel today is like they felt the day after it happened, even though it's been over a year, right?
So a Groundhog Day situation?
Not just in that they literally think it happened yesterday, but more in the sense that the intensity and frequency of mm-hmm. those waves of grief is as though it just happened. And perhaps even more importantly is that these are the folks who can't really function in their day-to-day life because this is happening. So this is the person who, you know, really just can't get dinner on the table for her kids because her mom died even more than a year after that death. Or a man in his community who, you know, has been the guy everybody goes to for advice, who feels so disconnected from everyone. He feels like he just doesn't care. He just doesn't want to have these conversations, right? A journalist who can't get through an interview without falling apart into tears, right? So you can see that's sort of a different experience than what most of us have. And so the critical piece to me is that our psychiatrists, our therapists, our psychologists have never had any training and education in grief, ever.
So it's not like it's taught.
No, it's not taught. It's not taught in medical school. It's not taught in graduate school. And what it means is, by having this diagnosis, they're going to have to be trained in what typical grief looks like in order to make the difference. And that, I think, will make a generation of change, where people have more psychoeducation about what this is like. And then what happens when there are complications and people don't adapt? And we have actually empirically based treatments, psychotherapies that we know help people.
That's fantastic, because now it's like we have the language, we have the actual conversations that are starting to happen where they need to happen. I'm all for that.
It has been a wonderful conversation.
I really appreciate that we're both bringing this to the world, you know, these conversations.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much, Dr. O'Connor. We appreciate you so much. And for those of you listening, follow us on the social medias. We are on Facebook, Instagram, and sometimes TikTok. If you like what we're doing, please consider supporting us on Patreon. We have a lot of fun stuff on there. This has been the Unchosen Fork.